Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Tonight on The Readout. Are you ready?
I'm absolutely ready. I've been ready. I'm hoping with all of my heart that they call me, because as I showed on the stand against Michael Avenatti, I don't need someone to speak for me. Mm-hmm. And I relish the day that I get to face him and speak my truth.
The first Trump criminal case to go to trial might not be about classified documents or January 6th. But in the end, it might be this woman, Stephanie Clifford, stage name Stormy Daniels, who brings down Donald Trump. Also tonight, I have some thoughts about Ronna McDaniel and the normalization of the dangerous damned lies from the Republican Party. Plus, not one, but two big announcements involving my friend and colleague, the Rachel Maddow. Stay tuned for that. But we begin tonight with a date now set for the first criminal prosecution of a former American president. Of course, I'm speaking of Donald Trump. And that date is April 15th. Mark your calendars. No, it is not one of the two trials for trying to overturn the 2020 election or the one for grossly mishandling classified documents when he left the White House. This one is for falsifying business records to hide the hush money payments Trump signed off on ahead of the 2016 presidential election. Those checks were written by Trump's lawyer, Michael Cohen, to pay off adult film star Stormy Daniels and keep her quiet about her alleged sexual affair with Trump, while Melania, Trump's third wife, was pregnant with his fifth child. Now, I know the idea of Trump getting busy with Stormy Daniels is not the image you want littering your mind at the dinner hour, just like this trial is not the one most people were hoping for. But it may very well be the only criminal case to go to trial before the November election. But that's not to say that it's not an important case, because in the end, it is not a trial about paying off a porn star. It's about lying to the American electorate to influence an election by suppressing negative information about the candidate. Trump paid Ms. Daniels to keep their relationship secret, not from Melania, but from voters. That's why he did it. And remember, the payoff came at a time when Trump was facing harsh backlash to the Access Hollywood video of Trump claiming he could grab women by the, you know what. At the same time, he was courting once reluctant evangelical voters. And let's not forget that Michael Cohen went to jail in part for those very payments. So why shouldn't Trump, who was listed as individual one in the indictment of Michael Cohen, today, on what was originally scheduled to be the first day of the trial, Trump's lawyers failed in their attempts to convince the judge to further delay it or even dismiss it. Judge Juan Marchan was described as appearing uncharacteristically furious as he called out Trump's lawyers for accusing the Manhattan DA's office of prosecutorial misconduct, but providing nothing to back up the claim. Before making his ruling, Marchan added that, quote, it's odd that we're even here and that we've taken this time. Trump has said that he would be appealing that decision, but the judge said appeal or not, he expects to see Trump in court next month for the trial. And while Trump may have to finally face accountability for at least some of his actions, he is still catching breaks. As today's hearing was underway, a New York appeals court judge handed him a pretty hefty one, reducing the bond required for his civil fraud verdict and buying him more time. He now has 10 more days to put up a $175 million bond rather than the original nearly $500 million amount that was due today. The appeals court provided no explanation for its leniency. Joining me now is Melissa Murray, law professor at New York University and MSNBC legal analyst. Tim O'Brien, senior executive editor of Bloomberg Opinion and an MSNBC political analyst. And Tristan Snell, former assistant attorney general for New York and author of Taking Down Trump, 12 Rules for Prosecuting Donald Trump by Someone Who Did It Successfully. Thank you all for being here. Let me start with you, Melissa. No explanation from the appeals court as to why they gave him more time. Can you explain?
So this is a 5-judge panel. We don't know what their reasoning is, but it seems clear from the order that they thought that Judge Engoron's order limiting Donald Trump's family's ability to run this company and, of course, imposing that huge $465 million fine was excessive. They reduced that to $175 million, which is exactly the amount that the Trump organization had pressed for in the first instance. And they basically stayed all of the other conditions involving the family's running of the organization, with the exception of the imposition of a special monitor to review all of things. That gets saved. So it does seem like this intermediate appellate court was incredibly sympathetic to Donald Trump. So a win for him today, but not a total win, because $175 million is still a lot of money. He's probably going to have to put up about $200 million in liquid assets or collateral in order to get a bond for this. So he's not out of the woods yet, but this is a significant win for him.
And it doesn't change the underlying rule. He still owes the $455.
He still owes the, again, this is just while he's appealing that decision. Yes.
Does he have $175 million?
He can probably get it. I think he's getting pressed up against the wall right now in terms of what he has on hand that's liquid, that a surety company would feel comfortable bonding because of the collaterals there. They're not going to want to take little bitty pieces of a bunch of different real estate. They're going to want to go after his cash. What's perplexing to me is he already said last week that he has $500 million. After a year ago saying he had $400 million growth, and then in between those two moments saying, actually, I don't have anything.
Yeah.
And I think in that context, I think the appellate court didn't do a service towards a defendant being clear and honest with the court. Even if, and I think the appellate court clearly thinks that Engoron overreached, I think. That, you know, they've stayed both the size of the judge, not the size of the judgment, but what Trump needed to put down to appeal.
Yeah.
But they also stayed keeping the boys out of the business and some of the other punitive things that Engoron put in place around the business. So it indicates to me that they felt he overreached. Having said all of that, that's what gets ironed out in an appeals process. They've sort of gotten into the middle of this now and cut away at some of the foundations of both the ruling, and they've signaled what they think about the whole process. And that feels untoward. On the other hand, Donald Trump and people of means routinely get breaks in the judicial process that we average, you know, parking toll violators do not.
Do not. You were practically almost laughing. I saw you. I think you want to say something, Tristan. I feel it in my spirit. So say it.
Yeah. The whole, as you put it, it's, you know, first he had $400 million. He stated that during one of the E. Jean Carroll cases. Then in between it was like, oh, I've got nothing. Yeah. Now all of a sudden it's like, oh, I've got $500 million and they're trying to take it.
No, he has
from
$11 billion.
$11 billion.
Plus one. Let's talk about where he might be able to get the money. Let's play this. This is, let me just read this. So there is a piece that's called Trump's Media Grift Goes Public. This might be the way he finds the cash. Donald Trump has this thing called Truth Social, which nobody's on but his hardcore fans. It's losing a bunch of money. It's in the red. However, what's unique about this thing of really about to go public is whether it's a short-term play like the Trump NFTs and trading cards, only scaled way up, or a long-term scheme along the lines of the Trump Hotel in D.C., where corporations, foreign governments, and the GOP faithfully opened up their wallets to curry favor with the sitting president. Will Trump dump his shares quickly once this thing goes public and cash out before the whole thing goes belly up? Will he hang on to the shares in hopes that he wins the White House and can then spend 4 years selling high-priced ad space to the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, coal companies, and every Republican candidate who knows what's good for him? Which is it? I mean, he could kind of do all of this, right? Because it sounds like a pump and dump. Could it work?
Well, to begin with, though, he's locked up for 6 months.
Right.
Once the company comes public.
I mean, he
gets diluted. So,
right.
So the other thing is his stake is not going to be $3 billion. As of tomorrow morning, I guess.
Right.
It'll probably be, I think, $780 to $800 million.
He's got 60% of the shares.
The board can tell him he can go ahead.
That he can take it.
To get a waiver from the board, though, I think would expose the company to serious liability from shareholders. I mean, again, for the board to waive the lockup provision and allow him to dump the stock.
You're basically putting up a neon sign that says, go sue me in Delaware for shareholder liability.
And there were two guys from The Apprentice who actually started this. If you guys don't know the whole Truth Social story, two guys from The Apprentice start Truth Social. Then it's going to be bought by this sort of shell company. Then that goes public. And then somehow Donald Trump gets $3 billion. This sounds like a pump and dump. If you were still New York AG, wouldn't you be prosecuting somebody for this?
Look, I am not, contrary to popular belief, I do not have like a red telephone that connects me to my old colleagues.
However, thought that red thing next to you was the red telephone.
You thought this was the telephone.
I did.
It's this right here. I have to believe that they're at least looking at this.
Yeah.
They cannot not be. Just don't.
It's the way he gets the money.
The thing is, I mean, he's using a vehicle, SPACs, without getting into technicalities. They are designed to avoid the normal IPO process, the normal financial disclosure to reassure investors that you're buying into something that has a track record.
Right.
And it's transparent.
It's profitable.
Full disclosure.
Yeah.
And this is a business that's basically built on Donald Trump becoming president. So his posts on Truth will become more valuable.
Yeah.
That's the business model.
Let's talk about this other case. Because the D.A. Bragg case, I think, Melissa, gets short shrift.
Because
it's Stormy Daniels. Right. It's about, you know, ew, we don't want to think about Donald Trump with a porn star. She also says ew, by the way, Stormy Daniels. And I love her. She's great.
She's earned her money.
Talk about this case, because this is actually the case that's going to happen.
No, I think that's right. And again, I do think it gets short shrift because the facts are so salacious and it's so lascivious. But it is a species of election interference, and Alvin Bragg has consistently talked about it in that tenor, that this is like the lead up to what we see on January 6th. It's the dress rehearsal, keeping information from the voting public in order to maximize or optimize your chances for election.
Right.
And again, to do anything to win. And you see that again happening on January 6th. So again, I think the two cases actually run together, and we dismiss or poo-poo this case to our detriment.
And here's the thing, Tim. I mean, today, one of Donald Trump's fans, I guess we're assuming while he was in court, because our reporters saw him in court, he was not typing, but someone posted to his Truth Social something comparing him to Jesus the Christ. And this is the week before Easter weekend, is this coming weekend. And they compare him to Jesus. And they quote the Psalms 109 in the New King James Version. But I think there's a few lines that they might have missed. It says, let an accuser stand in his right hand. When he is judged, let him be found guilty. It says, let his children continually be vagabonds and beg. Let the creditor seize all that he has. Let his posterity be cut off. In the generation following, let their name be blotted out. Let the iniquity of his fathers be remembered before the Lord. And why? Because he did not remember to show mercy, but persecuted the poor and needy man. Don't mess with a former Sunday school teacher on the Bible.
Amen.
The biggest sin in the Bible is persecuting the poor and the immigrant. To quote that and not actually know the Bible, probably a little bit of an error on
or
the part of his fans.
Lose track of what Christianity is meant to be about.
Love. Indeed.
Love and forgiveness.
Yeah.
At its core, you know, in the Bible. And you are there. They're comparing someone who is not loving, who is not forgiving, who's a vicious racist, and he's trying to torch the Constitution. He is the last person on earth who should be compared to any religious figure, much less Jesus Christ. And I say that as an agnostic.
Yeah.
And it's a measure, I think, of some of the cultish qualities that cling to Trumpism, which is you'll compare him to anyone you worship because you worship him, and in that process you look past all of his horrors.
And the thing that's so ironic about it is that the Stormy Daniels payoff happens because he's trying to court evangelicals.
Yeah.
He's trying to make them look past what he said in that Access Hollywood video and get them to worship him instead of Jesus, which is idolatry. But he managed to do it because they did. This Bible verse is a Psalm of King David. What they did to trick evangelicals into worshiping Donald Trump, like Baal in the Bible, is to say he's King David. But you know what?
Right.
Jesus didn't do the wrongs that he was persecuted for and executed for. Trump did.
Right. That's the difference.
Is he going to be convicted, in your view, in the case about the payoff to Stormy Daniels? I mean, Michael Cohen was.
I do believe so. I think that this is a very compact fact pattern. It's a very easy story to tell. There's not a lot of documents. You've got a tape recording. You've got a number of witnesses. And then you can say all you want about the different witnesses. But, you know, Michael Cohen has been saying the same truth over and over again for 6 years, ever since he stopped working for Trump. And Stormy Daniels has been saying the same thing about this over and over again. And then you've got David Pecker, who was the one who actually received the money. And then I think we've got the wild card of what are we going to hear or not hear from Alan Weisselberg. But it doesn't matter. You've got the paper. You've got the recording. You're going to have a couple of witnesses. I think you get a conviction. I think you then are left with the legal question of, was it done in service of a different crime?
Right.
And that's ultimately going to get decided up on appeal. But as for the jury, I see a conviction.
Does he spend a day in jail?
I mean, again, for this particular crime, and again, it is a misdemeanor in New York unless it is attached or bootstrapped to another crime, which makes it a felony. And again, that will be worked out, I think, on appeal. But it's not the kind of thing where you're going to see him do a lot of jail time. He may not do any jail time for it. And so whether or not it moves the needle, I think, is an open question. But I think it cannot help to go into this election cycle as a convicted
felon. That's right.
Yeah.
He will then be, in addition to all the other records he set as president, not just the first multiply indicted or even singly indicted former president, but also the first felon former president if he is convicted. But, you know, we'll see what happens in the case. Melissa Murray, Tim O'Brien, Tristan Snell, thank you all very much. And coming up, my thoughts on Ronna McDaniel, plus some big news to announce involving my friend and colleague Rachel Maddow. But first, a major development in the UN Security Council on Gaza with a surprising move from the Biden administration. The readout continues after this.
Kent State's reputation in the fashion industry is something you would hear from everyone when you're in New York City.
I will say we're quite well known for being hard workers.
Kent is really known for delivering well-rounded students.
Kent has one of the most prestigious fashion programs in the U.S. and also internationally ranked.
Our alumni are in every corner of the industry, every job position that you can imagine.
They all are ready. They have all the courses. They have everything under, you know, under their belt.
Today and every day, Planned Parenthood is committed to ensuring that everyone has the information and resources they need to make their own decisions about their bodies, including abortion care. Lawmakers who oppose abortion are attacking Planned Parenthood, which means affordable, high-quality, basic health care for more than 2 million people is at stake. The right to control our bodies and get the health care we need has been stolen from us. And now, politicians in nearly every state have introduced bills that would block people from getting the sexual and reproductive care they need. Planned Parenthood believes everyone deserves health care. It's a human right. That's why they fight every day to push for common sense policies that protect our right to control our own bodies and against policies that interfere with decisions between patients and their doctor. Planned Parenthood needs your support now more than ever. With supporters like you, we can reclaim our rights and protect and expand access to abortion care. Visit PlannedParenthood.org/future. That's PlannedParenthood.org/future.
Today, the United Nations Security Council passed its first resolution calling for an unconditional ceasefire in Gaza. It was a 14-0 vote. Note that I said it was unanimous, 14-0. And that is because in an astonishing and rare move, the United States abstained. Here you see Linda Thomas-Greenfield, U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, voting to abstain, clearing the way for the measure to pass. The U.S. has vetoed three previous resolutions demanding a halt to the fighting, and just a few days ago had presented its own resolution to the Security Council, using the toughest U.S. language yet, calling for an immediate and sustained halt to the fighting in connection with the release of the hostages. It was also the first time the U.S. had used the term ceasefire since the war began. But the U.S. resolution failed after Russia and China vetoed it. Still, that resolution and Monday's decision to abstain are the latest glaring signs of the Biden administration's frustration with Israel's approach to its war on Hamas in Gaza. And it's a notable break with America's longstanding defense of the Israeli government, usually come what may. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who is the source of the Biden administration's frustration, reacted angrily to the U.S. vote to abstain, canceling a high-level delegation to Washington for meetings with U.S. officials. The meetings had been scheduled to discuss alternatives to a planned Israeli offensive into Rafah, the southern city where more than a million people have sought refuge, amid U.S. concerns over the death toll in Gaza, now topping 31,000, and the growing risk of mass starvation. Joining me now is Trita Parsi, Executive Vice President of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, and Naira Haque, MSNBC columnist, former State Department Senior Advisor, and former White House Senior Director. Thank you both for being here. Trita, this is a big deal. Explain to us, give us some context as to why it is so major for the U.S. to abstain.
It is a very big deal because we have seen in the last month and a half or so that the administration had shifted its rhetorical position and started talking about a ceasefire, talking about the need for the fighting to end, et cetera. But we had not seen any real shift in its position. today by abstaining to this resolution, which had the clearest demand for a ceasefire yet, we actually saw a change in the position as well. Now, that's not enough, however. It all depends now on the implementation of this. And only the United States and Biden has the leverage to be able to put pressure on Israel to actually follow through and get to a ceasefire. Whether that happens or not remains to be seen. But at least we have taken one step forward in the right direction.
You know, and Naira, it is clear that there are political incentives for President Biden to shift his position, obviously rifts within the Democratic base. But also, you know, you and I talk a lot about the rise of the Global South. I just want to note for our audience who put forward this resolution. It was the 10 non-permanent members of the Security Council: Algeria, Guyana, Republic of Korea, Sierra Leone, Slovenia, Ecuador, Japan, Malta, Mozambique, and Switzerland. And I want to let you listen to Ambassador Carolyn Rodriguez-Burkett, who is Guyana's permanent representative to the United Nations. This is what she said on Monday.
After more than 5 months of a war of utter terror and destruction, a ceasefire is the difference between life and death for the hundreds of thousands of Palestinians and others. For the people in Gaza, there is man-made starvation, and we are already seeing evidence of a man-made famine. All of this when there is food available, but deliberately withheld.
It definitely feels, Naira, that this is a rare instance, even though it was an abstention of the U.S. allowing the Global South to speak.
Oh, and even the fact that prior to this, South Africa is the country that tried to bring a case against Israel, right? Given South Africa's own history of apartheid and how that language has been used in the Israel-Palestinian context, that was also a deeply powerful move at the UN. The UN was originally created largely to be European powers, right? Western powers having dominance and continuing in a diplomatic way the imperialism that they had presented to the rest of the world for so long. Reform at the UN to even bring in members of the Global South onto the Security Council has been part of that recognition that so much of what is done in the global body impacts people outside of the United States, right? Like the big global economies, the G7, the G20, all of those, ultimately, they control the money, but the impact is on the people in countries like Guyana, like South Africa, and in the Global South.
And Trita, let's talk about that, the implementation, because you said the important thing is now what happens next. You've still got a big fight within the United States and Europe against UNRWA, which is a UN agency that has helped to feed Palestinian people. You have what does appear to be mass starvation, perhaps near famine conditions in Gaza. What would you expect if the U.S. is serious about getting a ceasefire that they do next? You still have hostages stuck there, too. There's a lot they still have to do.
I mean, ultimately, nothing is going to change unless Biden is willing to put a halt to the arms sales to Israel. According to an Israeli general, if the U.S. stops sending the arms and the ammunition, the Israelis will run out within 5 days, and then we will have a ceasefire. So far, Biden has not been willing to do so. And I have to say, there was also a missed opportunity in all of this. The fact that the U.S. abstained was so positively received. It was a moment of healing. But then the U.S. turned around, the Biden administration turned around and started saying that this resolution is not legally binding. That's actually factually incorrect. But what it did, it had really created a lot of tensions with all of these different countries that saw this as an opportunity to be able to mend fences with the United States, to bring the U.S. along for a ceasefire. And then the Biden administration turns around and said that this is not legally binding. And incidentally, that would also mean that the call or the demand for the unconditional and immediate release of all the hostages is also not legally binding. Why would the administration say such?
Let me let you weigh in on that, Naira. What is going on here? Because it does feel like they're still trying to have it both ways. But there's a clear enough rebuke that Bibi heard it and canceled his meetings in the in Washington. Your take.
It's the difference between the United Nations being a place of norms and standard setting and bilateral relationships between two countries being where the real action happens, where real change is made. So that's what Bibi is reacting to. The fact that the United States was no longer doing the we support Israel no matter what at the United Nations, where frankly, often it is needed given the threats that Israel has faced on the world stage. But on the flip side, Bibi is also facing a hard reality
reality back at home, where people, even his own war cabinet, is looking to remove him and make a change to his own war policy. So this is this extreme reaction of pulling back a delegation from the United States is not really even about the U.S. relationship. It's about Bibi's sending signals to people in his own country that he is still a strong and confident leader.
We are out of time, but it'll be interesting to see if Biden keeps moving in this direction and takes Trita's advice and actually puts some meat on those bones. Trita Parsi, Nayara Haq, thank you very much. Coming up, there is a reason that NBC's hiring of Ronna McDaniels hits different. We'll take a look at just how pernicious her big lie was up next.
My name is Molly, and I'm a political science major at Kent State University. Kent State has these core values, kindness, respect, and purpose in all we do. Ever since I was old enough to understand the legal system, I've wanted to help serve justice, and I would like to be a prosecutor for the city of Cleveland and then hopefully move up to the county in the Justice Center downtown. Kindness and respect go a long way. As a prosecutor, you have to be kind to all parties of the courtroom to truly help everybody involved.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
In politics, we sometimes have lies, lies, and damn lies. There are things said in politics that are untrue, but ultimately benign in that they mainly impact the politician and his or her family, even if they are embarrassing. I've been faithful to my wife when it turns out that's not true, comes to mind. There are things that become untrue when circumstances change. George Bush Sr.'s vow to never raise taxes, which he thankfully reneged on when faced with an economic crisis. And there are just plain lies, including lies that can be dangerous to people's lives and even to our democracy. The lie that the 2020 election was stolen from Donald Trump is one of those damned dangerous lies. It is the notion, widely peddled by Fox and other right-wing media, by Trump and Marjorie Greene, the pillow guy, Clarence Thomas's wife Ginny, and other MAGA cultists, that through massive, multi-state cheating and fraud, carried out mainly in Black and Hispanic communities, Trump was made to appear to lose the presidential election and that he actually won. It is a lie, or really a series of damaging lies, that have literally put American democracy on the brink of collapse. Trump invented the big lie for the smallest boy reasons, embarrassment. He knew before the election that he was likely going to lose, largely because of his mishandling of the COVID pandemic, which broke out early that election year, 2020, killing a million Americans before it slowed down. And killing disproportionately white Republicans in red states, by the way, because it was they who rejected wearing masks or getting vaccinated because they had been taken in by snake oil salesmen in the right-wing griftosphere who had them drinking horse dewormer and maybe injecting bleach or irradiating their insides rather than taking advantage of Trump's own Operation Warp Speed. Bottom line, the pandemic was out of control. Plus, George Floyd's live street execution by a Minneapolis police officer in May of 2020 had young Black and white Americans and even corporate America leaning woke rather than MAGA. And it wasn't just Trump who knew he was going to lose. Roger Stone knew it. Trump's campaign knew it. Pollsters knew it and warned about a red mirage. And I knew it. So they decided to just lie and get Trump's millions of superfans to believe he didn't lose, that it was just stolen. It wasn't just stolen just from him, but also from them. Now, how do you do that? Well, first, you take advantage of the fact that states needed to react to the COVID pandemic by finding a way for voters to cast ballots without gathering in person and maybe spreading the virus. So what if you say that by doing that, states making an emergency accommodation to allow people to vote absentee from home or put their ballots in drop boxes was really a way to steal the election?
One thing that has changed is the way many people are voting this year. In 2018, Michiganders overwhelmingly approved Proposal 3, which allows no-reason absentee voting. McDaniel, along with other Republicans, aren't happy about the mail-in system.
We're really concerned about states like Michigan that are upending their entire election process this close to an election, that could wreak havoc.
And what if you even get your hand-picked Postmaster General, Louis DeJoy, to literally slow down the mail? So maybe the ballots will arrive late, and then you can say that, too, is fraud.
On the eve of a national election, at a time when the CDC is advising people not to gather, limit outside contact, the Postal Service started removing 671 high-speed mail sorting machines across the country. You sent out a letter, embarrassingly, in July, to 46 states that said the post office can't guarantee that we can deliver the mail in time for the elections in November. Either through gross incompetence, you have ended the 240-year history of delivering the mail reliably on time, or the second conclusion that we could gather is that you're doing this on purpose and that you're deliberately dismantling this once proud tradition.
And then on election night, when Republican voters who had said hell no to absentee voting because they didn't believe the pandemic was real anyway, we're told to vote in person because absentee voting and drop boxes are fraud. When they see that the first votes that get counted night of the early and election day in-person votes get drowned out after midnight when the absentees are counted, meaning what looked like a Trump win when they went to bed is a Trump loss by morning, the idea that the election was stolen will be baked in. And the angriest among them might even promptly descend on voting centers. And then, what if you say that instead of states sending the real Biden slates of electors to Congress after counting the votes, Republicans who run those states, which just so happen to be battleground states, should send Congress this alternative slate of Trump electors, since without the COVID accommodations, which caused all this supposed fraud, Trump would have won. This guy, who tried to get those fake electors to the vice president, shows you the way.
There are all kinds of irregularities in Wisconsin in the 2020 election. And in order to make sure that the case just wasn't determined to be moot, they had to have an alternate slate of electors, just like Democrats have done repeatedly in all kinds of different states. There was nothing untoward about what they did. There's nothing illegal about what they did. They were just an alternate slate of electors.
Yeah, so that's a lie. But then, if you throw in a made-up story that even the in-person votes can't be trusted because the Italians and also Venezuela's dead dictator have been playing with the voting machines, you now have the big lie. And Donald Trump doesn't have to be embarrassed that he lost to Joe Biden. He can just say he didn't lose. And he can get thousands of people to literally commit felonies trying to help him stay in office despite losing. These are not unfaithful to my wife lies. These aren't even, I said I'd cut taxes, but now I'm raising them lies. These are making people doubt the validity of elections and therefore democracy lies. These are get people so angry they storm the Capitol lies. These are lies that make people participate in a RICO scheme to correct the election in Georgia lies. These are lies that put people in prison because they believe the whole thing. These are lies that get people hurt and even killed. And one of the entities that helped Donald Trump push these lies was the Republican National Committee, the RNC, which is the official arm of the Republican Party. They're the ones that attacked Republicans like Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger for investigating the assault on January 6th by accusing them of persecution of ordinary citizens engaged in legitimate political discourse. For the last 7 years, until about a month ago, the chair of the RNC was Ronna Romney McDaniel. She dropped the Romney from her name, apparently, because Donald Trump hates Mitt Romney for voting to convict him in both of his impeachments. And Ronna is Mitt Romney's niece. She is also, as of last week, a very, very well-paid contributor to NBC News, something that has alarmed many of us in this company. Because Ronna McDaniel has been a major peddler of the big lie, including pushing Michigan Republicans to send fake electors to Congress. She did that in high-pressure phone calls to state officials in Michigan. According to the Detroit News, which broke the story of the call, McDaniel joined Donald Trump on a November 17th call while he pressured two Republican members of the Wayne County Board of Canvassers not to sign the certification of the 2020 presidential election. She sat by while Trump told these folks that they would look terrible if they signed the documents after they first voted in opposition. McDaniel added, quote, "If you can go home tonight, do not sign it. We will get you attorneys." Well, over the weekend, NBC's Kristen Welker, the moderator of Meet the Press, asked Ronna McDaniel about those lies.
Did you not have a responsibility as the RNC chair to say before January 6th, the election is not rigged, that Donald Trump lost, given that there were audits, given that there were more than 60 court cases that occurred all across the country? Listen, and that Donald Trump lost.
The reality is Joe Biden won. He's the president. He's the legitimate president. I have always said, and I continue to say, there were issues in 2020. I believe that both can be true. You can say massive laws were changed. They were changed through courts or through secretaries of state and not through the legislative process in the name of the pandemic that took away safeguards to the election.
Ronna McDaniel, who now works for a news organization, apparently still believes, or at least is still unwilling to stop saying, that expanding absentee voting during a global deadly pandemic is election fraud and theft. And she apparently still thinks there is a justification for committing state and federal felonies by submitting fake elector slates to Congress instead of the real ones so that the loser of a presidential election can stay in power anyway. I wish I was fibbing, but I'm not. My guests and I have much more to say about this after this short break. Don't go anywhere.
But to the question, though, do you disagree with Trump saying he's going to free those who've been charged?
I do not think people who committed violent acts on January 6th should be freed.
So you disagree with that? He's been saying that for months. Ronna, why not speak out earlier? Why just speak out about that now?
When you're the RNC chair, you kind of take one for the whole team, right? Now I get to be a little bit more myself, right?
Okay, let's dissect all of this with some of my esteemed NBC family colleagues. Molly John Fast and Charlie Sykes are joining me right now. And Charlie Sykes is an MSNBC contributor and columnist. Molly John Fast, Vanity Fair special correspondent, MSNBC contributor and host of the Fast Politics podcast. Thank you both for being here. Molly, I'm going to come to you. We were talking during the break, so I'm just going to bring our conversation aboard. I think that the reason I wanted to do it that way is because I feel like people have kind of forgotten what the big lie is. It isn't just Trump saying, I won. He was saying black and brown people getting to vote absentee in these swing states is inherently fraud.
Yeah. I mean, what's so upsetting about the big lie was that it was targeting black and brown people. It was this idea that we cannot have a multiracial democracy, that they cannot. And again, this is the whole ethos of Trumpism, right? Is this racism that, you know, you can't have a black president. You can't have an equal society. We can't have what the dream is, what we're supposed, what we all came to this country for.
Yeah.
And so when you talked about that, I was so moved by it, but also I remembered how important it is. You know, we are all here. You know, we make democracy work. Our grandparents, our great grandparents, we came here for a better life. And so I was really moved by that. And I thought it was an important thing.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I want to read what Liz Cheney, Charlie, said about Ronna. And this is what Liz Cheney, a very conservative right wing Republican who probably voted with Trump 90% of the time when she was in Congress. Ronna facilitated Trump's corrupt fake elector plot and his effort to pressure Michigan officials not to certify the legitimate election outcome. She spread his lies and called January 6th legitimate political discourse. That's not taking one for the team, as you just heard her say. It's enabling criminality and depravity. The idea, Charlie, please respond to the idea that lying about the election and claiming Detroit voters didn't have the right to vote absentee and therefore they are fraud. How is that taking one for the team? What team?
Yeah, well, obviously, it's not Team America. Look, what is absolutely incomprehensible about Ronna McDaniel being hired is this is not about right versus left. It's not about Democrat versus Republican. It's not even whether or not she's a political hack. The problem with Ronna McDaniel is that she is a co-conspirator and an enabler who lied about this election and And as you demonstrated just a few minutes ago, continues to lie about this. I mean, her defense is, well, I lied about this stuff in the past because I was paid to lie, and now I'm not paid to lie anymore, so I can be more myself. But the reality is that she continues to push the big lie. And, you know, it is worth stepping back and going, look, what is happening here? Is this about... is this access journalism? Because I'm not sure who you get access to. Or is it an attempt to appease an incoming Trump administration, which has been threatening to take action against corporations? Whether it's appeasement or access, it needs to be seen in the context of the fact that we are not in a normal political season, and that the journalistic organizations cannot behave in a routine, normal way. But I'm not even I am old enough to remember any time when someone would have hired somebody who had engaged in this kind of criminal adjacent deception. And Liz Cheney is actually calling her out. You know, it is not as if there are not conservatives who have something to add. But this is not about having a conservative on the air. This is about somebody who has been joined at the hip with Donald Trump's attempt to deceive the American public, disenfranchise millions of voters, including my vote in the state of Wisconsin, and continues to do so.
And this is not about not having Republicans on.
Right.
My good friend Michael Steele is the former also RNC chair, who guest hosts this show and is my friend. One of the best broadcasters on this network is Nicole Wallace, who is a brilliant broadcaster and a former Republican who worked for a president. I literally was in a campaign to work against George W. Bush.
Yes.
It is not about that.
No.
We welcome Republican voice. I wish more Republicans. I want Adam Kinzinger and Liz Cheney to get right here and come talk to me. The reality is, this isn't a difference of opinion. She literally backed an illegal scheme to steal an election in the state of Michigan.
Right. It's not about partisanship. We have to be pro-democracy. That's the goal here. And she, you know, it's fine to have your own views.
Absolutely.
But you can't have your own reality. And we all know that the 2020 election was free and fair. And she couldn't even say it on Sunday.
She's still saying
there are problems with it. The problems was a global pandemic. And that's what happens in a global pandemic. I mean, that was really, I do think, and I would also add that the road to authoritarianism is paved with people like Rana, people who repeat the lies they know are not true.
Yeah, and it is also paved, Charlie, with capitulating in advance, which is, I believe, what is written in How Democracies Die, is that it's saying that we have to entertain the idea that the election was stolen on an equal level as we entertain the idea that we should be a multiracial democracy, that these things should be made equal so we're being, quote unquote, fair. That is not fairness and balance. That is capitulating to an autocrat in advance by saying, yes, we will take your apparatchik and allow them to be elevated and platformed with us, with journalists.
I actually think that's the most potentially alarming part about this story, and I hope that they will try to clarify this, because Donald Trump has very explicitly said that if he gets into power, his presidency would be one of retribution, and that he would target media outlets and use the power of the federal government to go after license holders like NBC and CNN. Now, is this capitulation in advance, saying, okay, we think you might be president and we have to make nice with you? We actually have to treat you in a different way. If that is the case, and I'm raising this as a question, that's the kind of appeasement that I think ought to be very, very concerning to people. And again, it's not about differing points of view here, because there are many people, Michael Steele's a perfect example,
absolutely,
who will have a different point of view. But Ronna McDaniel played a specific role. I can't forget, I can't get out of my head the fact, remember, she was the one who hosted that press conference at the RNC with Sidney Powell, where Sidney Powell was advancing some of the most bizarre, toxic lies about this. And this was sponsored by Ronna McDaniel as head of the RNC, who then tweeted out the videos of this. And as far as I know, it's still up on the web.
Wow.
So Ronna McDaniel is not just somebody who had an opinion about this. She was an active enabler and co-conspirator in this attempt to overturn the election.
I appreciate you both. Charlie Sykes, Molly Jong-Fast, thank you. And thank you for standing up for democracy. And I will tell you, Charlie Sykes and I both used to do radio, and we were on opposite sides, because Charlie is an actual real conservative, not the Trump fake kind, and the kind that I deeply respect. Thank you very much, Charlie and thank Molly. You. Appreciate you both. Okay, coming up next, a big announcement that you do not want to miss. You don't want to miss it. Come right back. We'll tell you on the other side of the break. Okay, before we go tonight, I've got a couple of big announcements involving the great Rachel Maddow. First, Rachel will be joining me tomorrow night at 7 p.m. Eastern Time following the Supreme Court arguments about the abortion pill mifepristone. And then on Saturday, April 6th at 7:30 p.m. for all the New Yorkers, Rachel and I will be at the Apollo Theater in Harlem for a conversation about my new book, Medgar and Merle, The Love Story That Awakened America. We'll discuss the extraordinary lives and legacy of civil rights icons Medgar and Merle Evers, explore the grassroots work that went into winning basic rights for Black Americans, and the repercussions that still resonate today. Go to MSNBC.com/Medgar and Merle for tickets, and we hope to see you there. Even if you're not from New York, just come out of New York and see it. Okay, that's tonight's readout.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.